Prime Minister! Prime Minister!
Mr. Speaker, sir, may I join with the Leader of the Opposition in congratulating my right honourable and learned friend, the Member for Hexham, and my honourable friend, the Member for Oxford East, for proposing and seconding the Royal Address. They did so with great humour, great eloquence and distinction. I was very pleased indeed when my right honourable friend, the Member for Hexham, agreed to propose the Royal Address. We knew we'd hear from him a speech which we enjoyed enormously, and we did, in all its parts. He ranged extremely widely from his historical research to his great experience of regional aid, and of course he negotiated our entry into the common market. But I was interested that he also said, please take part in the Council of Europe, which has a wider and larger membership. And of course, we on this side fully supported everything he said about the importance of the defence of the realm. We thank him for his historical research. I suspect he'll find it regurgitated in many after-dinner speeches, as tends to happen when these treatises come up. He spoke about Palmerston's reluctance to go to his constituency. I seem to remember that there was a time when my right honourable friend was standing as a candidate for the LCC, and he was taken very ill at the beginning of the campaign and was unable to take any part in it at all, and he was subsequently returned with the highest Conservative swing in London. I hope not too many people will follow his example in that respect. It's good to see my right honourable friend in such buoyant and vigorous form today, and I would like to say how grateful we are to him for the skill and wisdom that he has brought to a generation of post-war politics. I also thank my honourable friend, the Member for Oxford East, who spoke very deeply about education. We know from what the Leader of the Opposition said that his own education was quite remarkable, and we're sure that it enlarged his experience in many ways. We shall, of course, take to heart his own comments and references on the needs of our schools and the potential of our school children, especially given his constituency background. We thank him very much indeed and congratulate him once again on his contribution. With regard to the Right Honourable Gentleman, the Leader of the Opposition, I note that at one stage he compared me to Wellington. I'm very grateful to him. Wellington won many famous victories, particularly in defence of Britain. So I would like to think that his comparison was really rather apt. I found it difficult to find my way through his rather rambling speech. I noticed that he was very critical of our manufacturing performance. May I remind him that manufacturing output has risen by 10% overall since the 83 elections. The manufacturing, yes, it's going up and up and up and doing very well. Yes, since we were returned by the people last time, manufacturing output has risen by 10% overall. How the honourable members will loathe good news. Much more, manufacturing investment grew by 5.5% in 1985. Manufacturing productivity has increased each year since 1979 at an average rate of 3.5% a year. Manufacturing export volumes are at record levels. Manufacturing profitability at its highest level since 1973. Why doesn't the Right Honourable Gentleman acclaim those who take part in our manufacturing industry and are doing so well with that excellent record? The Right Honourable Gentleman also referred to the assets from North Sea oil and their investment, and he didn't seem to approve of it. May I remind him that overseas assets have gone up from £12 billion in 1979 to £80 billion now, which is an excellent record. May I remind him also that in spite of what he said about poverty, Britain enjoys a higher standard of living now than we have ever known. And when he spoke to those unfortunate to be on supplementary benefit, may I also remind him that supplementary benefit is way above the levels of the last Labour government. ambitious speech sets out a full programme of legislation for a session. We shall be introducing a wide range of measures and building on the successes we have already achieved. Measures and policies further to strengthen our economy, to encourage wider ownership, to improve the education of our children and young people, to care for those who need help, and to conserve and improve the environment, and to protect our people from crime and the fear of crime. Mr. Speaker, every gracious speech under this government has stated our commitment to prudent financial management, and this gracious speech reaffirms that commitment. The Right Honourable Gentleman had something to say about public spending, so shall I say something about it. Public spending as a share of national income will continue to fall as it has since 1982. And as my Right Honourable friend the Chancellor said on Thursday, the public sector borrowing requirement in 1987-88 will be held to 1.75% of gross domestic product. That was the figure indicated at the time of the budget in March. In other words, there will be no expanding of public borrowing. When public finances are consistently sound, Mr. Speaker, the economy can and does withstand sudden pressures, such as the war in the Falklands, a year-long coal strike, and the halving of the oil price. Nevertheless, even as recently as a debate last Thursday, some of the opposition claimed that the government's achievements were built almost solely on North Sea oil. Yet in spite of the dramatic fall in the price of oil, we enter this new parliamentary year with good prospects for growth, exports, investment, for low inflation, and a more promising outlook for unemployment. Honourable members opposite. I'm so sorry, I didn't see the honourable gentleman.
Would the honourable lady say that the government's policy has been an outstanding success in no's? Would she say it's been an outstanding success in Knowsley?
Speaker, the honourable gentleman had his answer from the benches behind me.
Order. Prime Minister.
Members opposite, give only a grudging welcome to the fact that inflation is down to 3% and is set to stay low. Of course we want to see it lower still. Honourable members opposite don't seem to welcome the prospect of 3% growth next year, showing the increasing strength of the part of the economy which is not related to oil, which is, of course, most of it. Next year's 3% growth will be the sixth year of growth at close to that average level. Indeed, since 1981, Britain's economy has grown faster than France, Italy, and a little faster even than Germany. The opposition don't like the fact that employment has grown by more than 1 million jobs since 1983. And it's the growth in new businesses and new jobs which really offers hope to people who are unemployed. And the opposition can't bear the fact that the nationalised industries are now less of a burden on the taxpayer. The losses at British Steel alone were many hundreds of millions a year when we took office. Last year, British Steel made a profit, and people like to work for an industry that makes a profit. Total investment, Mr. Speaker, is at record levels, and that's another fact which doesn't fit the prejudices of the opposition, and it's forecast to rise still further next year. And there's one fact honourable members opposite simply can't stand, and that's the ever wider spread of ownership among the British people. Something which is flatly against the spirit of the Labour Party's Clause 4 and their objective of extending the powers of the state and increasing government control over people's lives. Well, under this government, there are 2.5 million more homeowners now than there were when we took office. The number of accounts in building societies has increased from 31 million to 52 million since 1979. Some 1.5 million employees are sharing in the success of the businesses in which they work. Share ownership has doubled since 1979, and that's just a start. Millions more people are considering buying shares in British Gas. And next year, British Airways, Rolls-Royce, and the British Airports Authority will follow British Gas into private ownership. And personal equity plans start in January to encourage small investors to own shares in business on the basis that their dividends and capital gains will accumulate free from tax. Honourable members opposite can't stand this spread of ownership which has come about under Conservative governments. They dislike the independence from government that it brings to all our people. Honourable members opposite despise the wealth creators. They look for every opportunity to undermine the people who do so much to create our national prosperity. The opposition want to take power back from managers and workers and give it back to the trade union bosses. They want to put penal taxation back on the shoulders of those who lead the way to growth and jobs. They want to put newly privatised industries back in the hands of the politicians, and they want to compel nationalised industries to put people back on the payroll, regardless of whether there is a job for them to do or not. Always back. Back to the very policies which nearly broke Britain. Those aren't the policies which Britain needs or wants. Ours are the policies which are creating efficient industry and commerce, which is the only basis for sustained advance. Mr. Speaker, as my honourable friend, the seconder of the Loyal Address, said, and as the gracious speech says, a bill will be introduced to abolish domestic rates in Scotland. We are determined to reform the existing system of rates and local government finance. The reform in Scotland comes ahead of that in England and Wales because Scotland has suffered a revaluation with all the hardship which that entailed. The present system is unfair. It's unfair on domestic ratepayers, since on average only 1 in 2 local electors pay rates, and in some cases, for example, Liverpool and Lambeth, the number is fewer than 1 in 5. And it's unfair on business ratepayers, who are at the mercy of high-spending local councils. The rate support grant system has become so complicated, for example, involving 68 different indicators, that voters can see no clear link between the rates they pay and the quality of services they receive. The government's proposals provide a clear solution to these problems. The new community charge will be payable at least in part by all local electors. And our proposals for controlling business rates will protect businesses from the ravages of high-spending councils. We shall also reform and simplify the system of grants from central to local government. Local government will gain the stability which it needs, and local councils will be made more clearly accountable to their electorates. Indeed, one sometimes wonders to whom some councils are accountable. It was 3 Labour councils, Haringey, Lambeth and Hackney, which invited Sinn Féin representatives and gave a platform to terrorism. It is some Labour councils which seem more interested in lavishing ratepayers' money on anti-police propaganda than in helping the police to protect local people from drug pushers and muggers. It is in Labour council chambers that we see the tactics of bullying and intimidation as in Southwark and Camden last year and in Haringey only last month. Mr. Speaker, that's what today's Labour Party is really like when it's in power. I give way to the Honourable Gentleman.
I'm obliged to the Right Honourable Lady. She has in fact mentioned the fact that only one in five of the citizens of Liverpool and Lambeth pay rates. Would you care to explain why that is the case?
Why?
As the Honourable Member is aware, there is a total rebate of rates on some people, and under the new community charge, there will be a rebate, a major rebate, but people will pay something of the community charge, which we believe is right. Mr. Speaker, the gracious speech refers to legislation on teachers' pay and conditions, and the Right Honourable Gentleman indicated that they would oppose the legislation which is to come before the House. For the past 2 years, the teachers' unions have been campaigning for higher pay, and some of them, but not all, have been using the disruption of children's education as a weapon. My Right Honourable friends, the Secretary of State for Education and the Secretary of State for Scotland, have set out for the teachers' unions and management a package which offers, first, a clear definition of their duties and responsibilities, and second, substantially higher pay for teachers, with greater rewards for better teachers and head teachers. The pay proposed is fair and reasonable, indeed generous. The duties and responsibilities are those which any conscientious teacher could reasonably be expected to fulfil. And I hope that the employers and the teachers will take this opportunity to put the profession on a much firmer footing, with better pay, a new career structure, and proper terms and conditions. Part of the problem we now face in England...
Sir Russell Johnston. Grateful to the Right Honourable Lady. She referred to the offer of a package. She referred to the offer of a package on wages and conditions. Is it not equally the case that in Scotland the main report proffered a package which the Secretary of State himself said was indivisible and he weren't to pick and choose? But he did pick and he did choose.
The Secretary of State accepted virtually the whole of Maine. He staged its benefits. He staged the actual wage and salary increase that most people, I think, regard as reasonable in view of the level of the increase for teachers, which I seem to remember in Scotland would amount to a 30% increase over a period of just about 2 years. In England and Wales, it's about 25% over 18 months. And I think most people in Scotland would accept the reasonableness of staging the increase. But part of the problem we face in England and Wales arises also from the very structure of pay negotiations. Pay is negotiated under one set of arrangements, terms and conditions of service under another. And as the gracious speech makes clear, we shall therefore be introducing legislation to repeal the Remuneration of Teachers Act 1965 and to introduce new arrangements to settle teachers' pay and conditions of service within the resources available. This legislation will tackle a long-standing problem. There is now a real chance to make a great advance in education performance and to restore to teachers their standing and prestige in the eyes of their pupils, parents, and the community as a whole.
Does the Right Honourable Lady not realise that the teachers were in negotiation with their employers, were in the midst of such negotiations, as we're talking about the immediate negotiations that are now going on, and in the midst of those negotiations, the impatience of the minister was of such a nature that, having issued a diktat a fortnight ago, he then proceeded to say that the negotiations were a waste of time and whatever was coming out of them, he would veto in a manner which is not acceptable to any of us, never mind only the teachers.
Mr. Speaker. Those negotiations, as the Honourable Gentleman is aware, had dragged on and on. In Scotland, there had been the main report. There was danger of disruption. My right honourable friend came and told the House of his very generous offer. He told the House that the money would be made available on the conditions we had always indicated, that there would be a reasonable career structure for teachers in order to keep the best teachers in front of the classes and to make certain that the better teachers were paid more. And he also said that it would be dependent upon the thing we've been saying for a very long time, proper definition of duties and conditions of service. We have been saying those things for a very long time. In spite of that, the negotiations have not come to any fruitful conclusion. And therefore, my right honourable friends, the Secretary of State for Education and for Scotland, came and laid their plans fully before the House for a fair and indeed generous offer. Yeah. Mr. Speaker.
Prime Minister, is it not a fact that when we took office, the teacher's salary structure was 13% below Houghton? After this offer that's on the table, the teachers will be 10% above Houghton. Is that not a fact?
Mr. Speaker, I understand that my honourable friend's figures are correct. Mr. Speaker, and I'm grateful to him. Mr. Speaker, the centrepiece of the legislative programme in the gracious speech is the Criminal Justice Bill. In the battle against crime, government must provide the necessary level of resources and ask Parliament to give the police and the courts the powers they need. The government has provided substantially increased resources, and more were made available in the autumn statement. This bill will represent a further strengthening of society's defences against the criminal. The bill will have three main themes. First, it will build on the foundation of the Drug Trafficking Offences Act and give the courts greater powers to confiscate the proceeds of all other types of crime from which substantial gains are made. It is unacceptable that criminals, after serving a prison sentence, should be able to live comfortably on the proceeds of their crime. Secondly, it will strengthen the jury system by abolishing peremptory challenge, a facility now clearly open to misuse and against the interests of justice. And third, the bill will contain far-reaching proposals to help the victims of crime. For the first time, it will give victims a statutory right to compensation for serious injuries. And by allowing children who have been the victims or witnesses of sexual or violent attacks to give evidence to a court by way of a television link, it will make it more likely that the perpetrators of these horrifying crimes are brought to justice. Like many others, Mr. I want to get to the end of this section, please. The argument is very closely knit. Like many others, I've been appalled by the terrible cases of child abuse. Crimes against children fall to depths of evil, which place them in a category of their own. Together with so many others, both inside the House and outside, I've long supported the National Society for the Prevention of Cruelty to Children, and long hoped that as time went on, the need for its work would fade away. Alas, the need is as great as ever. Everything the government, the police, and the courts can do to bring the offenders to justice and stretch out a helping hand to their victims will, of course, be done. But we, as citizens and neighbours, must be ready to respond ourselves to signs that a child may be in peril and need help. The Criminal Justice Bill will show that we are resolute in our commitment to increase the protection given to the citizen. And I believe the help for victims and the tougher penalties in the bill will be welcomed throughout the country. I give way to the Honourable Member from the front bench.
Since the Right Honourable Lady has spoken about the government's concern for victims, will she explain why the changes in the Criminal Injuries Compensation Scheme will reduce by 28% the people eligible for criminal injuries compensation?
It's coming out.
Mr. Speaker, the Right Honourable Gentleman must wait for this bill in order to discuss these matters. Extra money has been made available for this scheme to come into operation.
Order. The Prime Minister is not giving way. Prime Minister. Order.
Mr. Speaker, the gracious speech says the government. I'm going on to defence now. Mr. Speaker, the gracious speech says the government will maintain the United Kingdom's own defences and play an active part in the Atlantic Alliance.
Order. The Honourable Gentleman knows the Prime Minister doesn't give way. He must resume his seat. Prime Minister!
When I meet President Reagan at Camp David in a few days' time, we shall be discussing...
Order. The Honourable Gentleman, order. The Honourable Gentleman well knows... The Honourable Gentleman... No, order! The Honourable Gentleman well knows that if the front bench does not give way, or any member doesn't give way, the Honourable Gentleman must resume his seat, and I ask him to do so. Order.
Down, boy.
Prime Minister, order, and I say to the Honourable Gentleman, please remember that if the Prime Minister does not give way, he must remain his seat, and I so request him.
When I meet President Reagan at Camp David in a few days' time, we shall be discussing the way forward on arms control after the Reykjavik meeting. The significance of Reykjavik is that after many years of talking about arms control, there is now a prospect of major arms reductions, provided that the Soviet Union does not make agreement on all arms control measures dependent on others accepting the constraints it wants to put on SDI. The next step is to negotiate specific and detailed agreements, agreements which take account of the West's vital concerns with balance and with effective verification. The government would support the conclusion of an INF agreement which would set limits on medium-range nuclear missiles, or even eliminate all such weapons in Europe and the Western Soviet Union. But such an agreement must be accompanied by credible and effective verification and by strict limits on Soviet SS-20s in the Far East and by agreement on how to deal with shorter-range nuclear missiles, of which the Soviet Union has many more than NATO, and it's worth remembering that large areas of Britain are within range of those weapons. An agreement on INF weapons would be a vindication of the policy of firmness, a policy in which this government gave a lead and in which it was supported by Britain's allies, but not, of course, by honourable gentlemen opposite. Their only policy is one-sided disarmament. If we had followed their advice, if we had not stationed crews in Pershing, there would have been no question of getting rid of the SS-20s targeted on Europe. The government also welcomed the commitment at Reykjavik to seek agreement permitting 50% reductions in strategic nuclear weapons, subject again to strict verification. This would meet our long-standing aim of preserving deterrence at lower levels of nuclear weapons. But while the Warsaw Pact retains its massive superiority in chemical and conventional weapons, and while the basic causes of conflict between East-West are undiminished, we shall continue to rely on nuclear deterrence for Europe's defence. Yet, Mr. Speaker, the party opposite...
She would support a 50% cut in all strategic nuclear weapons. Would a 50% cut, which, as she rightly says, would change the whole shape of things, be the sort of deep cut which she has many times told us would justify putting British nuclear weapons on the negotiating table?
Mr. Speaker, on strategic ballistic missiles, first, if there's to be any question of it, it has to be and I hope there will be a question, subject to effective verification. As the Right Honourable Gentleman knows, that will not be easy to attain. I hope it will be attainable. When we get there, we will consider the other question. But I must make it absolutely clear that I believe Britain must continue to maintain its independent deterrent at a necessary minimum to make it effective. There is no point in us giving up all our small nuclear weapons for the Soviet Union only to keep even as many as half as it's got now. Yet, Mr. Speaker, the party opposite would have us give up not only Britain's own nuclear weapons, but the protection given by the American nuclear umbrella. If I may quote the Right Honourable Gentleman, the Leader of the Opposition, speaking on the 28th of September, he said, if we're not prepared to use the weapon system ourselves, we certainly won't be asking anyone else to jeopardise themselves by the use of that nuclear weapon. Indeed, he went on, I think it would be immoral to do so. What he means in plain language is that a Labour Britain alone in the NATO alliance would have no answer to nuclear blackmail. Honourable gentlemen opposite, go to great lengths, indeed absurd lengths, to fudge the truth about their policies. When their defence spokesman was asked whether...
Order.
When their defence spokesman... When
order. Their defense, Prime Minister.
When their def-
oh, order. I order. Please, I ask... Order. I ask the Honourable Gentleman to resume his seat.
When their defence spokesman was asked whether... When their defence spokesman was asked whether, in the light of some of the comments by the Right Honourable Gentleman, the Member for Leeds East, the Labour Party's policy on nuclear weapons is multilateral or unilateral, the Right Honourable Gentleman, the Member for Clonesley, said, well, these are long words, aren't they? And Dennis is a bit of an intellectual. I try, he said, to avoid words like multilateral and unilateral. I bet he does. Let me remind him what unilateral means. It means giving up our nuclear defences while letting the Soviet Union keep theirs. That's the way the opposition would undermine Britain's security.
I order the Honourable Gentleman to resume his seat.
Gentleman is doing everything he can to stop on getting across what Labour policy is on defence and especially no nuclear defence. The truth is, Mr. Speaker, that one cannot be a loyal member of NATO while dissociating oneself from its strategy. No one knows that better than the Right Honourable Gentleman, the Member for Birmingham Sparkbrook, when he said in 1983, and I quote, there is an inherent inconsistency in saying we will remove all foreign bases from this country while we have the NATO commitment in our policy. I agree with him. The truth, Mr. Speaker, is that you cannot expect others to stand by you unless you stand by them. The truth is that the United States' commitment to Europe would be fatally weakened by a Labour Britain contracting out. The truth is that the opposition's policies would lead us inexorably down the road to a fearful and a fellow-travelling Britain. Let me remind the Right Honourable Gentleman, the Member for Leeds East, of what he said in 1981. He was asked what he would do if Labour adopted a policy of unilateral disarmament. He replied, and I quote, I would fight to change the policy before the general election. And if I failed, he said, then I wouldn't accept office in a Labour government.
Order. No. I've said to the Honourable Gentleman, please resume his seat.
Prime Minister.
Dennis, stand up.
Is that still his position, or has he joined the unilateralist bandwagon which has swept to control the Labour Party, with the Right Honourable Gentleman, the Leader of the Opposition, holding the reins?
Answer.
Give way.
Mr. Speaker, this government knows where its duty to our country lies. We have a duty to keep Britain's defences strong, a duty to our allies in NATO, a duty to keep faith with our armed forces, of whose superb professionalism and dedication we are so proud. We shall continue the modernisation of Britain's conventional forces. We shall maintain our independent nuclear deterrent, and we shall ensure that the NATO alliance is able to continue to play its indispensable role in defending freedom. Because we on this side of the House know, and the country knows, that strength is the surest foundation on which to work for peace. There's only one party in Britain which is united in support of a clear and strong defence policy for Britain. I give way to the honourable member on the third bench.
I'm grateful to the Prime Minister for permitting me to intervene. Can I ask her then if she would tell the House, is her government's nuclear policy based entirely on her postulate that the Soviet Union is ready to attack us?
Right, the Honourable Member indicates clearly that he doesn't begin to understand at all the policy of nuclear deterrence, and that explains a lot about the Labour Party's unilateral policy. Mr. Speaker, the proposals for the coming year carry forward our programme for encouraging enterprise on which the new jobs depend, for a wider spread of ownership, for rolling back the powers of the state, and for providing effective care for those in need, and for supporting the institutions which uphold the law. This government, Mr. Speaker, will press ahead with all those policies in the coming year, and, Mr. Speaker, in the years beyond. Yeah.